afternoon, begging your pardon, we're starting at least an hour later than what we'd like to start. We're scheduled today on Senate Bills 327 and 1127. What we'd like to do is reverse the order of those, and they're already reversed on this, Katie. Great, thank you. And go ahead with Senate Bill 1127, and we'll have a public hearing, continuation of 1127, and I think we've got some folks signed up on 1127, so let's go ahead and continue to the public hearing portion of 1127. Ms. Coy and Linda Barber, would you like to come forward, please? I beg your pardon, Linda Barbie. You right?
Yes, I was smiling at the representative.
In charge of the flying pig there, too. That's if you want to use any acronyms, you're welcome to do that. That's a piece of the American Cancer Society. So. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafouri. I'm here today representing the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. We support 1127, and we're very interested in keeping us in the bill. If I could take just a minute and tell you about my personal history, Mr. Chair, I've represented the architects since 1985 and the land surveyors since 1993. Both of those boards are now under the semi-autonomy statute. So I've experienced the relationship between the board and the professional association, and I've experienced the relationship between the legislature and the board for quite a long time. And the conclusion that I'd like to make is that, frankly, the only difference that I've seen has been positive, and there's been greater administrative flexibility for the board. There's more consumer protection for the public, and this is largely due to the fact that boards now have more time and more energy and more money because they had charged their own budgets to spend on investigating problems with the profession, those who are practicing without proper licensing and those who are licensed who are practicing improperly. It's been a great, I think, impact on consumer protection because of the predecessor of 1127. I'd like to make a quick comment about some testimony you heard yesterday. The quote was made that 1127 would eliminate state oversight of boards. My experience is that is absolutely not the case. This legislature is very interested in what happens with boards, regardless of whether they are semi-autonomous or not semi-autonomous. There's been a lot of legislative oversight of boards and professions, both before and after. There's a comment that this would increase the political involvement between the boards and professional associations. And again, I can say that I've watched that both before and after the autonomous statutes have passed. And I found, as a matter of fact, that most of the things that have come that have been good in the professions and the protections for the public have come from the professional associations working closely with the boards, such things as increasing standards, increasing for continuing education. These things originated from the professional associations. There has not been any laxing of regulations or rules or any attempts by any professional associations to ask the boards to loosen standards or in any kind of way decrease protection from the public that we licensed the people for in the first place. In summary, the Oregon Physical Therapy Association, I've talked to them, the members of the board and the members of the association both, about this bill, and they are in strong support of it. And I'd like to introduce Linda Barbie, who is the chairman of the board of the Oregon Physical Therapy, excuse me, of the Board of Physical Therapy Licensing.
Thank you, Mr. Clark.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to address you. I am currently chair of the Physical Therapist Licensing Board, and I do support the inclusion of our board in this Senate Bill 1127. And I'd like to give you just a couple of examples of how I think this will benefit the people of Oregon, which are constituents, the consumers of physical therapy services. I have a bit of personal experience with this because my day job is at OHSU in a management capacity. So I've been with them as we've gone through the transition from a state agency to a more autonomous organization. And my experience, much like Mr. Kafuri's, has been that nothing but positive things have come out of that. And in the most glaring, I suppose, effect has been an increase in our efficiency and our ability to move. It's become much faster in our approach to things. And I think the same thing can happen with the board. Currently, our board, as a state agency, is required to check in with the legislature with the e-board for major changes. Fortunately, to the best of my knowledge, we've never had to come to the e-board for additional money. But we have had to come to the e-board for additional spending authority when we've exceeded our budget in past years. That slows us down. That's a slow process that can take months. And meanwhile, we have investigations, we have procedures that are on hold and waiting that approval authority. Our issue this year in the past 12 to 18 months has been one of having a number of very significant complaints come before our board. We made a determination that as a volunteer board, we could not respond to a large number of serious complaints in a timely manner, and so we sought to hire a private investigator to help us with that. Pushing as hard as we could and getting absolutely wonderful cooperation from the Department of Administrative Services, see, I didn't say that.
Very good.
My teenagers stole all my change. It took us about 3 months to get an investigator hired, and that was expediting the process with good cooperation. As a semi-autonomous agency, that should take a matter of a few days to a week or two to do that kind of thing. And in the interim, we had 4 or 5 investigations on hold, and these were really sexual predator kinds of serious things that you don't want to see on hold. It's a public protection issue.
These were amongst the therapists themselves?
Yes, they were.
And you were having problems terminating your investigator?
No, we were having problems hiring an investigator.
Hiring an investigator to examine the case.
Right.
Okay.
And we did get it done, but it took 2 to 3 months. It was close to 3 months.
And that's the morass of government, the agencies, okay.
Approvals, bid processes, interviews. So, in summary, my primary interest in passing this bill is one of expediting our processes, was making us more responsive to our constituents. I should have heard that you've received testimony indicating that this might undermine, the quality assurance process that we go through, and I guess I have trouble believing that to be true. What I see in Senate Bill 1127 are a great number of requirements for reporting back to the legislature. There are public hearing requirements for budget and other processes that we don't currently adhere to. There's ample opportunity in there for the public to participate in our activities as well as for the legislature to oversee those by virtue of semi-annual reports. I think it's actually a greater extent of oversight than we actually have right now.
Can I ask a question about your board? The total number on your board?
4, 5, 7.
7. And public members on your board?
1.
Okay. Would you... according to the Pew Commission study, they recommended that approximately a third would be a better ratio of public to private or public to professionals. Would 2 members on a 7-member board be cumbersome if they were public, 2 or 3?
No, sir.
In your feeling, would be. Tell me about your public board member now. Is he or she a contributor or a follower, or do they attend?
Our public board member is actually a retired nurse from the Southern Oregon coast. She attends very regularly and participates in the board meetings. I do see both with the public member and the physician member of the board they're not quite as helpful in the process of determining professional standards, of determining when standards have been exceeded or violated because they don't have that professional background. So they're not quite as active in participating in investigations or complaints, for example. That burden does fall to the professional members of the board.
So in addition to a public member of the board, you're also required to have a physician on board.
It has 4 physical therapists, a physical therapist assistant, a physician and a public member currently.
Okay. Are there questions, Ms. Barbie, from the members of the subcommittee or the subcommittee? Begging your pardon, but there's some folks that have a lot more important things to do than what we're doing here. Not that this isn't the most important thing that should be done in the building, because I think it is. But that's just more. Other questions of Ms. Barbie or Mr. Corey? I just wanted to review briefly with you, if I may, some of the testimony that was given the other day relative to relative to not including the health related fields into 1127. And one of the things that was said was, we seek only guarantees that licensees meet certain minimal competency and education standards and who do not have a history of fraudulent acts or patient abuse. Tell me how you overcome that in the Oregon Board of Physical Therapist Licensing.
How we ensure that competency?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We do that by setting educational standards. We do that by administering a licensure examination, setting passing scores, that sort of thing. Some of our licensees, not all, depending on their level of licensure, are required to have continuing education, and the board audits those records. We obviously receive complaints, investigate all complaints, take disciplinary action where there are complaints that come forward. We are in the process of participating, and I would say we're 80% implemented in a national databank of complaints, disciplinary actions, and problems, so that when an applicant comes to us, we're able to access the information from the other 50 states, see if there's any history of illegal or abusive activities.
Mr. Chairman, can I answer that question? I'm sorry to interrupt.
You do receive information relative to from 50 states on a criminal history check and background, is that right?
That's right. We're almost completely implemented. There are some states that are still inputting their background on that.
Okay. Mr. Court?
Mr. Chairman, to answer that question, two points I want to make. First is that this legislature is in the process right now of passing a bill which was asked from by the board and introduced through the professional association working together to allow the board to discipline people that have done activities outside the state. Presently, our licensing statute do not allow that. So the situation that occurred was there was a physical therapist in the state of Idaho who had done some things that we didn't want to license that person here in the state. The person came here, and there was no way in our statutes for us to issue that license. This legislature is in the process of changing that statute, and we also are, Mr. Chair, in that same bill, increasing the civil penalty authority of the board, and that was at the request of the professional association. And we also, in that bill, are increasing the authority of the board to sanction people who are practicing physical therapy without a license, that is, people who are not licensees, which also is a new power that is in the process of being granted to the board. That was also brought by the professional association as a way of strengthening the board. So I think we push this. We, together, are making stronger standards. Now, the other thing I'd like to say is that we had a bill in the legislature a couple of years ago that allowed physical therapists for the first time to treat patients without a doctor's referral. When we passed this bill, there was a compromise made with the medical association to say that we would increase our continuing education for those physical therapists who do see patients on a direct referral basis without a doctor's referral, just directly self-referring. And that continuing education is run by the board, and again, it's an example of how the board and the Light Professional Association work together to strengthen standards, protect the public, and that would not change one whit by passage 1127.
Thank you. Let me ask one more statement, and then I've got a couple of questions along the sentence to Representative Messler's time, because he's got an airplane to catch in 45 minutes. So I need a response from the physical therapist licensing board folks and the association. Senate Bill 1127 opens the door for serious abuse of the public trust by eliminating state oversight of the boards. Give me your response to take care of that concern, please.
Mr. Chair, I truly believe that that 1127 includes more oversight with the semi-annual reporting that's required of us to report on our rule changes, to report on our disciplinary actions, our public protection activities. Those things are not required of us now. We only report them to you now incidental to our budget requests. When we come to you and say we need more money because we've had twice as many complaints, it's about the only time you currently hear that information. This would put that into statute and require that those reports are submitted to the legislature every time it meets.
Finally, I need you to respond to this statement. Increased autonomy will only serve to contribute to the lack of standardization of administrative process. The lack of standardization of administrative process.
Chair, if I may answer that, I've watched this in, as I said, before and after, and I don't think this legislature has had really any effect on standardization of process. I don't think that's been an issue that the legislature has been involved in, either before or after passage of the predecessor to Senate Bill 1127.
Okay, well, let's do a message.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I promise not to take 45 minutes.
I just want to clarify a couple of things. I thought I heard it in confidence. You mentioned some cases you've had, one involved pedophiles, I believe, or that type of activity. And then I heard you another time, Ms. Barty, make reference to criminal activity. And my question is, does your board get involved with that, or at what point do you turn that over to the police or the district attorney's office?
That is an interesting subject for us to deal with. Yes, we do get involved with that. Currently, we are often receiving those complaints of the typical one right now. We've got about three or four pending are sexual abuse in the third degree, I believe, generally. Those are coming to us from the district attorneys after the criminal charges have been filed. When it occurs the other direction, if we get that information first, our ability to share that information with district attorneys and police agencies, we believe, is hampered by Senate Bill 35, was it last year, 2 years ago, confidentiality laws and how much information we're allowed to share with other individuals and other agencies. Our current practice is that once we make a finding and administer discipline, we then share forward that information to the appropriate police agency. But as long as it remains an unproven allegation, it is the interpretation of our Attorney General that we cannot share that information.
Interesting with legislative fiscal officer office staff Katie Cannon, there is a bill that's coming through that correct the Senate Bill 35 deficiency, I guess.
Right. I think that it's Senate Bill
26.
Yeah, I think 326 and 235 last time.
235,
right. And I think I'm not sure where that is. My understanding, I think it's
in Corpus Christi.
It is an issue that concerns us.
I thought there were federal statutes that took care of the issue of pedophiles that you didn't have any choice, not even protected by the priest confessor at this point.
I don't know, it was just a concern, Chair Butler, that before they were not able to report this information to other agencies.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would want to be in their position to make that decision.
Yeah.
Just sure if I could just follow up. I think that evidently that is an area that we need to look at, or someone needs to work on, because it seems to me to be very awkward for your board to be dealing with those kind of issues. If there's suspected criminal activity, I would think you would want to appropriate people. And dealing with that rather than taking up your time. Well, your time should be spent with, do they qualify? Do they have a license? Are they qualified people that do the job?
Yes. It's And it's an issue for other boards. I'm talking with other boards as well. We are discovering criminal activity. There is a great deal of concern about how much we can share. So we're anxious to get that clarified for this legislative session.
President Hanson,
recognized. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Corey, you've been involved. You were involved with the Architects Board when it made its transition. What would you estimate for the Physical Therapist Board that there's either savings or increased efficiencies would be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, our experience with the Architects Board, and there are a number of people here who are agency heads who can. We've been talking before the committee started about filling out different examples of this. A lot of examples of being able to save money on the phone system, on purchasing, both in speed and price of purchasing. There are a lot of good reasons why we have purchasing requirements in state government, but there are times for small agencies when it's a lot easier to go down to the store and buy something, and a lot cheaper to just go down the store and buy something rather than go through a long process. I will say that it's going to take some time there are a lot of administrative rules that need to be changed. There are budgetary processes that need to be changed. So it's not something that happens overnight. But universally, the agency heads tell me that after they get those processes sorted out, and it's a great cost saving and allows them to spend their time investigating and not spend their time making budget recommendations to the Department of Administrative Services and then getting those back and having to redo them and then put them into the legislature. And that's been a very, very time-consuming process. And if we just have the ability to do our own budgets internally, that saves a lot of administrative time.
Any other questions of Ms. Barbie or Mr. Foy? Thank you very kindly.
Thank you.
Let's visit for just a moment regarding the agency reporting requirement. Ms. Cannon, can you tell us about the current under the current arrangement from Senate Bill 546 from the 97 legislature? There's some reporting. I understand that they have to continue on with the semi-annual audit and those kinds of things. Can you give us some feel for what all that includes at present?
I wasn't here when this occurred, Chair Butler, but I did get a copy of what was submitted. This is the Secretary of State audit, and then there was a summary by each agency that covered the specific things that were outlined in the reporting requirements. And my understanding, probably one of the issues that came out of this was the cost of the Secretary of State's audit. And in this bill, 1127, there is a provision in there that the Secretary of State has the option to do the audit, or they can contract with a certified public accountant to do the audit because of the cost. And that was the main issue that came out of that. Some of the boards that Dave Clinton may be able to address this better than I can. My understanding, this was presented, and that was the main concern that came out of there.
Mr. Plunkett, would you like to come forward? I think that would be important so that we know what the fiscal responsibilities are that you're facing under the existing Senate Bill 546. Do you have an audit performed annually or semi-annually or annually?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, under Senate Bill 546, there was required
Speaking the microphone, go ahead and give your name.
David Plunkett, Administrator of the Board of Education. Under Senate Bill 546, there was a required biennial audit, and then there was a performance audit that was required. That came to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, and they thought that that was not the intent, that because of the price tag of some $50,000 to $100,000 for a performance audit for each board. But anyway, the committee thought that probably was not the intent, and so then we reached an agreement to have self-reporting on those performance measures, which we did in that comprehensive report for optometry ours or something like this. And we had in that a copy of the audit, a copy of our self-reporting. We had copies of all of our administrative rule changes. We had copies of all of our disciplinary actions and board activities in this report. I think it's a pretty comprehensive report, and it's something that in the past you don't receive.
Now, just to ask a question about that, is there, as a result of the presentation of this particular audit report, and your examination of self-reporting on performance, do you receive any feedback from any governmental agency or any administrative body, the Department of Administrative Services or Legislative Fiscal or anyone from the state agencies?
As a result of the audit itself?
As a result of the performance and oversight?
No.
Tell me, and this is probably going to be a best guess. Well, first of all, this, I take it, is not a $100,000 document that you just shown us.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. Have you feel for how much that cost in relationship to the audits that were done by the Secretary of State? These are fiscal audits here, and you've got a performance as well as a fiscal.
Yeah, it's minimal. I would say we probably incorporate, and I'm estimating, maybe a week's worth of work in this report.
If the report, as a result of Senate Bill 1127, was required to have some administrative oversight, that is, it must be reviewed in some manner or fashion by perhaps Legislative Fiscal Office so that any red flags could go up, would that be a currency for the Department of Optometry?
Mr. Chair, we of course did submit copies to Legislative Fiscal, and for optometry, we sent out about 28 copies of this to everybody we thought might have an interest in it, and would have welcomed those comments. We actually did not receive any.
I guess.
But we did have a very good audit report, and there wasn't too much to comment on.
I guess to assuage some of the concerns that we've had expressed, if there were concerns relative to abuse or violation of the public trust or oversight or lack of standardization, administrative processes, those kinds of things, and in this process, the Legislative Fiscal Council for the Legislative Fiscal Office was required to respond to the performance measures that under this kind of an examination, then you could expect some kind of a response other than just no response. In other words, the negative confirmation means that they either got it or Newman dropped it in a garbage can on his mail route, I guess. At that point, Do you have any feeling about having some oversight so that some of the concerns that have been raised relative to the loss of administrative oversight might be addressed at the state level?
Mr. Chair, speaking for optometry, we would have no problem with that. I had even suggested yesterday that and my testimony that we come over and bring this report and present it to a committee of the legislature. I think we would all be happy to do that after legislative festivals had an opportunity to look at it.
Okay. Just one other, and it's a different line of questioning, a totally different issue. The number of levels of that the Board of Optometry licenses that you do administer, what are the types of optometric licenses that the Board administers?
The Board administers basically one license for optometry.
Optometry.
Yes, and we do. We do, of course, have active licenses and inactive licenses, that kind of thing, but it's one license.
Nationally, is there some certification, or is it the regional boards, or what's the other level of oversight there?
Well, in optometry, being a profession that's been around for a while, it's got a pretty strong national organization, and there's an organization, the National Boards of Examiners in Optometry, which actually give our exams, and it's members of all 50 state boards, and
it's uniform.
Yes, it's uniform.
Okay.
And this allows a person to go from one state to another because of that easily.
Are there any? Do you perceive that there's any public misunderstanding between the differences of these national licenses versus the state licensure? Because of the titles that are given in Oregon under Oregon statute, I assume that's just optometrists. Just
in optometry, is to the best of my knowledge, all states issue a license for a doctor of optometry.
Okay. Representative Hanson,
would it be fair to say that you've got a clear vision and are well focused?
I think so.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your input. We received information and testimony done from the State Board of Massage Technicians, the Physical Therapist Licensing Board, and the Oregon Physical Therapist Association. Some members of the Board of Radiologic Technology, former board chair, and then the chair of the Board of Trustees of the Children's Trust Fund. Is there anyone else that needed that's here to testify or to give input relative to Senate Bill 1127 and those organizations which are proposed to be included in this particular bill? We have today received, seems like this is the
place where we get these dropped on us. The additional language that was of concern yesterday relative to the job bidding rights issue. And that was on page 2, lines 37 through 39. I think each one of you should have, and I think you are involved with, is this standard language?
I've had this drafted. I don't know that it's standard. What it does is clarify what was testified to.
Okay.
And that being that those employees of those boards, state employees of those boards, would continue to accrue seniority rights, transfer rights, going back and forth. That's what we heard for yesterday. Apparently there has been some suggestion from DOS, that isn't how they read this language, notwithstanding what was testified to yesterday. This amendment clarifies that. So what would happen would be exactly what we were told yesterday would happen.
Was this run past Senator Nelson?
I actually don't know that it was. I actually don't consider it a substantive amendment. I consider it a clarifying amendment of what we heard the language is supposed to do anyway. It doesn't change the intent, as I understand it. All it does is clarify what we were told yesterday it does.
This is my understanding, Representative Leonard, that this would be for those employees who are going to the into the semi-independent board status and then would elect to come back into a non-semi-independent status, but back into full state board status.
Right, and what we heard yesterday from one witness was that this language that is currently here allows that for that to happen and allows that person to have their seniority when they go back be what it would be had they never left. That's what we were told yesterday.
Okay.
This language, in fact, makes that more clear that that's what happens.
Okay.
So no, I didn't talk to Senator Nelson only because it doesn't change what we were told the intent of the bill was. It just clarifies that.
Okay. Let me see if I need an example of when a time that would be used. This would be when a board member or when an employee of a board that was going to semi-independent board status would, after 5 years, let's say the board was folded back into and peeled back out for whatever reason, back out of Senate Bill 1127.
Mm-hmm.
Then they would come back in. They're presently covered. They continue with their state employee status in that interim.
And for the purposes of that board and that employment, will continue to accrue their seniority.
Okay.
You can transfer rights within that board. What this says, which again reflects what we were told it does anyway yesterday, is that if they were to transfer from the landscape architect board to DOS, that their seniority that they'd accrued while they were at the landscape architect board would count in their total state employment seniority.
Okay. So that I understand, except as otherwise provided by law, directors and employees of a board are eligible to receive the same benefits as state employees
mm-hmm.
and are entitled to retain their state of Oregon hire dates. And what we're inserting, or what's supposed to be inserted in this amendment, is transfer rights and job bidding rights, all without loss of seniority,
mm-hmm.
and to the direct transfer of all accumulated state agency leaves.
And what we heard yesterday was this current language that you just read actually does what A5 clarifies.
Contemplates within the language is
pretty much. That's right. It just makes it clearer that that's what it does. So
what we need to do is we need to go ahead and accept receipt of the amendment, subject to approval of Senator Nelson, and we've been unable to contact Senator Nelson. I want to make sure, and then we would like to have an opportunity to contact the Department of Administrative Service
okay.
to make sure that if there are any of the board members or employees that are subject to other bargaining rights under their current bargaining units that were not in violation of any of those
mm-hmm.
as well, so that maybe may need more clarification, but
I think that's what except as otherwise provided by law leaves some opening for those other eventualities.
I guess it would be except as otherwise provided by law or current bargain.
Well, that would be covered under except as otherwise provided by law, because the law provides for collective bargaining.
Collective bargaining.
Mm-hmm.
But we
had a concern about that. I talked to the legislative council.
You're comfortable with that. Okay. Okay, well, we'll acknowledge receipt then of the -A5 amendments to Senate Bill 1127 dated June 16, 1999. I appreciate Representative Leonard securing those for us, and we'll go ahead and receive those at this time and then seek substantive authority so that it's we don't have any difficulty with. Senator Nelson, who sent us this bill. Now let's see, did we have, I think that was the only provision for substantive change on as this bill? Is that right? Or did we
talk about the other amendment that drops out?
Because we did have the naturopath, and that was naturopathic examiners, and that was approved by
Senator
Nelson. Okay. I'd like to go ahead do one more item before we go into some serious discussion. And there's not sufficient today to go into any work session. But I'd like to have Katie, Legislative Fiscal Office Representative Katie Camp, just respond to the issues. And I want to be sensitive. House Bill 2465, which we passed through this committee to the full Ways and Means Review Pass recommendation, addresses some of the issues of consolidations relative to the Health Licensing Board for and none of the boards that are included here, but relative to workload and caseload and so forth and oversight issues. But I'd like to have a response as to the audit requirement. I am concerned that the independent private audit, including that which has been alluded to here today, the self-reporting on performance, that we have some oversight on that at the state level. Can you respond to that, please, Ms. Katie?
Sure, but let me make sure I understand the question. What you want me to do is to give some guidance as far as how that audit performance audit report would be handled by LFO in the future.
Yes, in the future, we've received, and I want you to know that I certainly appreciate the input relative to the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems concerning some of the rather serious concerns that they have, and I really appreciate those concerns. What I need to do is to make certain that at some point we have a degree of oversight sufficient at the state that standardization and administrative processes, that there is sufficient oversight of the boards through the self-performance evaluations, and then someone looking over the shoulder, because I don't know that this particular body or the e-board or others would have that level of oversight that would be that we're looking for. So I guess I need some, we got a CPA behind us here, and he called a comfort letter, I think is what he was called. So what I'm looking for is some sort of a comfort level that the board could anticipate that they will have somebody looking at the report rather than just handing them out willy-nilly. Would you like to have the
Legislative
Fiscal Office
Representative
Dallas Lyon come forward?
Mr. Chair, I might remind Mr. Lyon of the penalty for acronyms.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I am fully aware of the penalty for the use of acronyms.
Thank you, yes.
For the record, I'm Dallas Lyon. I'm with the Legislative Fiscal Office, and I also staff the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. During this last interim, the issues relating to, I believe, Senate Bill 656. I can't, don't remember the exact number.
546.
Were brought forward with the Secretary of Audit, Secretary of State Audit Division, as well as our office, which staffs the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, about the cost, and got the Joint Legislative Audit Committee to agree to this approach to oversight. That could possibly be done again with possible amendment. I haven't, I'm not familiar with Senate Bill 1127, but these semi-independent boards could be required to report to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee and be subject to their oversight during the interim, and the Audit Committee could be requested to present as a report to the Assembly in the upcoming session. That would be one option. I'm not sure if that's exactly what you're looking for, but that would be the intent of this approach that you see before you. The result of it is that binder, which contains all of the boards, I believe. Yes.
Well, I guess, and I know that Representative Leonard has been here a lot longer in the building than I ever hoped to be, but I know he reads every one of the reports meticulously when it comes across his desk.
Every one.
Every one, and particularly those with the funny little spiral binders around the end that had a little pasty across the bottom. those are the ones that really catch my attention too. So, but I guess the concern I've got is that I know that somewhere those need to be examined, particularly by people of the expertise of the Legislative Fiscal Office, not just to examine history, because I mean, as scriveners of history, accountants are pretty good scriveners of what has happened. We can tell you a lot of very useless information as regarding Landon. The concern is that I've got is that we be looking at these reports be examined for with the degree and level of oversight that we'd be looking for opportunities to perform better and more efficiently and to avoid the pitfalls and problems that you folks on a regular basis for these agencies while they're in the agency status are basically working with. So that's what I need. I need some comfort level that we'll have that level of oversight from Legislative Fiscal, and how do we accomplish it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, incorporated that prior bill was a very rigorous set of reporting requirements, which were felt to be somewhat burdensome fiscally. Something similar to that, incorporating those concepts of somewhat less fiscally onerous, could be put into the bill requiring some sort of reporting and oversight by the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. Again, the Legislative Fiscal Office staff to that committee would be involved, and to the extent that the fiscal audits of the Secretary of State Audit Division or other auditors would be incorporated, we could be involved in the review of those also, and the formation of, if you will, recommendations for the Assembly through the Joint Legislative Audit Committee with respect to these agencies. I think somebody could be crafted to provide that oversight.
Chair, can that be done with the budget notice? We do have access to a legislative fiscal staff measure summary, as it's called, and that staff measure summary could accomplish that. And it doesn't raise to the level of a budget note, but it appears in the next year for them to accomplish that. The current language provides that the board shall follow general accepted accounting principles, and those are standards. Keep financial and statistical information as necessary to completely and accurately disclose the financial condition and financial operations of the board as may be required by the Secretary of State. Secretary of State place any burden with regard to
the actual performance standards themselves, those under the old 546.
Exactly. Members of the committee, I don't see that that would be a problem at all.
Okay.
If we, I think that with respect to your thoughts of putting it before the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, maybe not in the budget note, but in the staff measure summary, so that it would have it as an item to be considered during the interim, maybe they achieve it.
Okay, and financial operations would also be included in that according to the current mode. Representative Hanson.
Could the oversight and reading of those reports be a role for the increased Congress chance?
I'm trying to be good. And not
can't control him. I'm not sure. You've been good for several days.
I
just haven't had any reason to worry about you at all. And representing.
I've been lying after the other night.
Yeah. Me and I both gone down there.
Boy.
When he explained it, somebody said, well, what are you going to wear when you present that bill? He says, I'm not going to wear anything.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, that's great.
That's very frightening.
You just try and be helpful.
Yeah.
And look what happens to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, and then the next paragraph, board shall prepare annual financial statement of board reviews expenses of the revenues and expenses and shall make statement available to public review. Board shall provide a copy of the statement of the Department of Administrative Services in the way of the 90th day. The concern that I have is that providing the copy and then that we have these basically negative levels of acceptance in lieu of conducting an outside the state may elect to accept the report of the independent certified public accountant. I'm not getting the level of, and so I guess what I would like to see is some kind of a staff measure summary report that we could come back with that would assure the public that the agencies are in fact accomplishing what they're intended to accomplish without placing in danger or in harm's way the public in any way, shape, or form, or violating the public trust as has been expressed as a concern. So I just would ask that we consider that as a part of the staff manager summary. Any other questions? Dallas, do you have other comments that you would like to make at this time? Okay.
Okay, you feel comfortable with that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any questions of Mr. Wyans while we've got him at the witness stand? Thank you very much, Dallas. We appreciate that comment. Appreciate your expertise, too. Okay, colleagues, I think it's appropriate that we from the comments of the proposed legislature, legislation, the legislative fiscal office report, under the comments of what this bill does, I think we need to go through and take a look. I think there's some things that absolutely have to be done relative to 1127, Senate Bill 1127. This is my personal interpretation of it, and we're not in work session. We don't have sufficient for a work session, but it would appear to me that the Board of Trustees of the Children's Trust Fund should definitely be given the latitude that they're requesting for independent status or semi-independent status and 501c3 charitable organization status. I did not ask Mr. DeHaan yesterday relative to the filing, but I understood him to testify that they were already a 501c3. So they've already paid the filing and are a nonprofit corporation. any comments from members of the subcommittee relative to the board of trustees of the Children's Trust Fund?
Well, Mr. Chair, actually, we covered that, I think, very effectively yesterday, and I just was wondering, it sounded there for a moment like you were you wanting to specifically make mention of the Children's Trust Fund in the staff measure summary of this bill, or where are you heading?
It's there already. The issue is there's five boards already under Senate Bill 546 from 1997. Mm-hmm. We've heard from a number of those boards, and I wanted to look just briefly at the four boards that have been recommended, or four boards or institutions that have been recommended for inclusion under measures under Senate Bill 1127. Again, my strongest feeling was immediately that the Board of the Trustees of the Children's Trust Fund be allowed to do exactly what the bill provides that they can do as an independent or a semi-independent board. Let's start with, if there's no objection to that, can we just continue with the very first board that's mentioned, the Board of State Board of Massage. We heard yesterday that they favored the semi-independent status. Anyone have major concerns with the State Board of Massage Technicians? Thank you very much. And we agree with that. Next, please. Relative to the second board, the Physical Therapist Licensing Board. We heard today from the Physical Therapist Licensing Board chair and Mr. Kapori representing the association. Comments from members of the committee relative to the Physical Therapist Licensing Board? Plus or minus, maybe 10 out?
I'd like to see them.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, I haven't listened to the testimony. I'm comfortable with them being included in this process.
Now, we heard, thank you very much, Sam Krupp. We heard testimony from the, you still got my dollar? Okay. OBRTs. We heard from the Radiologic Technology Board that they would like to, and again, we've had some on again, off again with that particular board, that they would like to continue with their rather extensive state oversight that they presently experience as a non-independent board, if you will. Katie, do you want to respond to any of the comments that we heard yesterday? Do you have any anything that, as a result of the three hearings that we've been involved with the Board of Radiologic Technology?
Let me go back a little bit, Chair Butler, and talk. In the budgeting process, if you recall, on 5026, this particular budget was in that budget measure with all the other licensing boards, and this particular board was taken out of that particular measure and handled separately. And one reason was because they had increased their fees from $3 to $5 a month, and there was quite a bit of response from their licensees that they were concerned about that particular increase, and so that board was taken out and handled separately. As it turns out, I think that the committee had reduced the fees to $4 a month, and then that was when it was still in 5026, and then when it was kicked out and then brought back again, you ended up at $4, but with a reduced budget. And there was concern from the licensees about this particular board and their handling, you know, I mean, how they operated. And so there is that concern out there with this particular board, and with the testimony that we received yesterday from Mr. Patterson, there seems to be some additional concern.
Representative Hanson, sir.
Now, yesterday I thought the testimony that we received was from the professional association, not from the board. Do we have a definitive statement from the board whether they want to be in or not?
From the board themselves, I think Mr. Harp is the former board chair, and Ann Warden, I believe, is a board member, but I'm not certain about that.
If I recall, Chair Butler, she was also a former board member.
Okay. But Mr. Harp was the former, the past board chair. And their indication was we need stability and licensing for the time being. They would like to opt in at a later date, and they recognize that opting in at a later date would need statutory authority to do so.
To opt in later?
To opt in later. And they acknowledge that.
It would be kind of my guess that this is going to be sort of a perennial piece of legislation that we'll probably be moving towards every session.
Yeah. And there might be boards that would opt out too. I don't know under what circumstances they would be opting out, but they might be opting out at a later date, and that's why it's important that we have the necessary language to protect those gardening association employees.
Mr. Chair, is there anyone here from the radiologic board today in the audience?
Okay. You'll recall that when we finalized that budget, what we ended up doing was that we brought it down to the bare nubbins at the end of the two biennia by plugging in additional cash to try and accommodate additional private investigations. We had some rather disturbing testimony that they didn't have 74 different examinations of their employees, of their board members. I think 52 of them dealt with certain issues and just failure to license.
For minor certification issues.
Yeah,
for the more serious issues there too, but they were relatively few, as I recall.
Yeah, there was a couple of DUIIs, and I think there was a couple of others, but I think we've had some testimony that they probably should be out. And then the fourth that is being recommended is that issue of the Board of Trustees for Children's Trust Fund. And then we've heard from the Board of Architectural Examiners. We did not hear from the Landscape Architect Board that I can recall. State Board of Examiners Engineering and Land Surveying, Geologist Examiners, and the Board of Optometry. And I think we heard generally positive responses from those five boards that are presently there.
Chair Butler, a clarification, are you indicating the possibility of taking radiologic technology out of this particular bill? If so, I'm asking because then I will work on having an amendment drafted.
That's kind of the sense of what I wanted to get from our board members or from the subcommittee members. I certainly am leaning that way myself as a result of having heard that budget de novo after the original hearing process. That would be my suggestion, is that we go ahead and we prepare. There's already an amendment, the A4 amendment, delete the Board of Naturopathic Examiners. So they're already pitched out. And what we would be doing on the face page, section 1, line 21, is that we would be scratching that as well, and we would have to have the substantive authority from the sheriff to do that. And we're going to have to go back to him on the A5 amendments already. Any objection to asking the staff to prepare that? Obviously, we don't have a quorum to make any decision on it, but I hesitate to spend the time and energy if we don't have some consensus.
Certainly preparing an amendment to take the Board of Radiology out, I seems wise to do. I'm a little torn on the issue from the standpoint that obviously it's a board that's been under a lot of stress, and rather than moving into this semi-autonomous status, if that board feels that would increase the stress on their organization at this point and would really rather stabilize, that's certainly a reasonable decision for them to make. The only thing I'm a little bit troubled with is in terms of the former board chairs and stuff. I think I'd like to have the current board either send us a direct message saying they want to opt out, or some sort of clarification that indeed former board members are seeking for the current board and clarification there that first the direction they want to go.
Well, maybe you should have blood there though.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Well, and that's one thing I'd like the clarification in terms of knowing which side, who's speaking for who on the issue.
I have a letter here from the Oregon Society of Radiologic Technologists.
This is a professional
group. Right, which is a professional group, and they're essentially not wanting, if I'm reading this correctly, they're not wanting to be included in this legislation as semi-independent status. And the board, am I hearing correctly that the board wants to be semi-independent? Well, the board doesn't want to be similar.
The testimony we received is that they do not want to be, they don't want the status, that they would like to be excluded from the bill. So basically what your association
based on what the association says, what the board is saying, and Mr. Patterson's testimony, which I'm reading here, that 90% of those licensed by the Radiologic Technology Board work for hospitals.
See, that is a
fairly major issue.
Let me go back to some of the testimony of Representative Schrader and some of the concerns that he expressed in our first testimony relative to that board, and that was, wait a minute, how many of these machines do you keep driving around the back of pickups? This is not something that goes from place to place. These are licensed in place in the clinics and in the hospitals where they're at. And really there was a question whether or not the state should even be involved in the licensing at that point, the licensure of the technologists themselves. Well, the technologists, to a person, all agreed that they wanted the level of oversight. There was a new limited entry examination, and we approved that renewal and approval of that examination as well. But there were a lot of concerns expressed at that particular point.
Mr. Chair, did Senator Bryant, I don't recall his testimony, did he specifically give us a reason why he wanted the radiologic technologists included in this legislation? I don't believe he did.
I don't know that he specifically included why it was that we didn't include that.
Sure, but my understanding of what Senator Bryant, how this was put together is they were asked, agencies were asked if they wanted to opt in, and he was really giving them the latitude to either opt in or opt out of this particular bill. So I think that's kind of, and some of them after they gotten into it and looked at it decided they wanted to opt out. The original bill had a lot of boards on it.
Well, Mr. Chair, based on what our discussion has been and everyone's testimony here, I don't have any problem with amending the radiologic board out of this bill. It doesn't seem like anyone associated with them really wants to be included, so I think that's probably fairly wise on our part, too.
That's the way I'm leaning. I having heard the testimony from two of the Senate bills, both the fee bill and the full bill, and then having compared the various licensing boards, this is one that does need additional hand-holding and additional oversight, at least for the time being.
So, Mr. Chair, we can always come back next session, and if their situation has changed and this continues to be a successful experiment in terms of creating semi-independent boards and agencies, however you want to put it, then we can always, there'll be others like the representatives of Hanson stated that will probably want to be part of this situation. We can include them at that time.
And they recognize that it requires statutory authority to be included in and to be some independent board. Okay. Let's proceed then and direct the legislative fiscal office to prepare a amendment then to accommodate the exclusion of that particular board, and then we'll repost. Now let's just take a look at the week. Friday we've got a funeral in the afternoon. Tomorrow is Thursday. Seems like every other day is Friday, and every other day is Monday. It's coming go so fast.
I can, Representative Butler, I can probably get an amendment out of Ellis or out of Lodge Council. I think so.
You've been turning around pretty quickly.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. I don't think that would be a problem. So let's continue this.
Let's go ahead and continue the public hearing portion of 1127, Senate Bill 1127A. With that request for tomorrow then, and then if we can come to a conclusion tomorrow, we'll invite the necessary number of senators down and if we can get some work in. So we'll go ahead and conclude this portion of the public hearing process on Senate Bill 1127A and carry it over until the next session. Okay. Let's come then to Senate Bill 327. And Mr. Ryan is here from Legislative Fiscal.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you remember yesterday, we were presented with in effect, was adopted with Clause 20 Bill 327 to do two different things. A, that which it was originally started to do, which was provide some additional retirement benefits for certain certain firefighters in the forestry department, and the second would be to accomplish an amendment to the Public Employees Benefits Board statute to provide for certain people who continue to avail themselves of the Public Employee Benefit Board health care package that pay for it themselves if they are eligible and qualified to retire but not yet receiving a pension. And this was presented to us yesterday. We didn't have an amendment to the bill, but we discussed it with Legislative Council this morning and with members from the Public Employee Benefit Board. So what I had to do was an amendment to Senate Bill 327. Legislative Council feels that the remaining two clause would enable this to happen. I can't talk it, there's a great deal of expertise to the issues, but Legislative Council was aware of them, the members of the Public Employee Benefit Board and Department of Administrative Services are aware of them. This was brought to the attention of Legislative Fiscal informally that there might be an issue, that the problem is bringing the public, the then it was called State Employee Benefit Board, and there was a bargaining unit benefit board where you had two different benefits boards that oversaw essentially the health benefits, health and dental and life insurance benefits for public employees. They have been brought together under one what is now called Public Employees Benefits Board, and they are the Public Employees Benefits Board is in the process of bringing all together for the year 2000 to consolidate and make just one standard set of rules. And in the review of these, it was found by their Attorney General that there was this, there needed to be an amendment to this statute. And in order to do that, they were searching for a relating to clause in a bill that was out there. And this was one of them, relating to pensions. And this does impact those people who are eligible to receive pensions, but who are not yet drawing in for whatever reason. You know, they may want to leave their money in the employee's retirement system to accumulate more and live off of maybe deferred compensation, or they may have some other, they may have some sort of golden handshake or something and able to live off of that for a year or two. But this is still enable them to keep their medical and retirement benefits. We have not yet done a fiscal on this. We have been told that There is an essentially testimony has been provided that the employees or the members under that would be eligible under the Public Employees Benefit Board would pay for the insurance. We have not talked to public to representative for Public Employees Retirement System as to whether this would pose a problem, but I do know that there are people here that are ready to testify as this. Again, it's just a public hearing for this. We still have the other issue of the retirement benefits for those in the forestry department, the forestry department. So it now provides two things if this amendment is incorporated.
Do we have Mr. Delaney is in the room, and I want to be sensitive to Director McDonald's time. I know he's testifying for another committee at this very moment. Okay, let's go ahead with some information and testimony on behalf of the Public Employee Benefit Board. We have Malia Ray, who is the administrator, and looks like she's got a hand out there.
That's one word, but two.
Hand up. Excuse me, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chairman Butler and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Maria Ray, and I'm the administrator of the Public Employee Benefit Board, and we greatly appreciate the patience of the committee in hearing this information for a second afternoon in a row. I wanted to just briefly explain a little bit about the late timing, which I think Mr. Weiland has already done, and to talk a little bit about the problem and what we hope will be the resolution. As has already been mentioned, this is a massive undertaking of the new board, which started its work last January, in the process of creating not only this new program, which is combining the two predecessor boards and activities, but also creating the new PEB program. The board committees have simultaneously been working on designing the program at the same time that they've been developing these brand new administrative rules. This issue surfaced in that process of comparing side by side the old world and the new world, and what we realized is that really there was a gap that existed in terms of what's currently part of PEB statutes. And quite simply put, as was stated yesterday, there are already 2,700 employees approximately who currently receive health and dental benefits from the PEB program. So we offer those services currently to those employees. What's occurred is that within that group, there are both State Employees Benefit Board eligible employees from higher ed and previous employees from a bargaining unit benefit board who currently do not qualify under the current vote statute language. What we're asking for today is your consideration of this new amendment 327-84, which we believe would correct that language and allow these current employees to continue to receive their benefits. As Mr. Weiland's already stated, this is a self-pay group of 2,700 employees who receive this benefit and pay the premiums themselves, so we don't believe that there would be an impact. And we do have representatives from Higher Head with us today who are also here and concerned about this issue. So we apologize for the late timing, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ray. We do have some folks here from higher education as well, and that's in addition to the 2,700 employees that are currently covered under the PED program.
That we currently cover higher ed employees under both of the two previous programs in PAB. What is unique to higher education is that they have a retirement option program themselves that is different from PERS. So what happened in this language is that it didn't incorporate those employees who take advantage of that optional retirement program by allowing them to participate in the PEP program.
Would it still be cost neutral to bring them into the program where they are presently under an optional retirement program?
Chairman Butler, it is the same situation in which they self-pay those premiums.
All paid by the employees.
I think we're all well versed on what the problem is and what the solution is. I think probably the only thing that would really be helpful at this point is if indeed the amendments that were drawn up today actually fit with the problem that you had yesterday. Will these amendments solve the problem? The other question I think came up yesterday was, I believe this, had you checked with the sponsor from the Senate that this...
We understand that, Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, we understand that Senator Troll has discussed this. We have not yet been able to get Senator Duncan to sign off, but we understand Senator Duncan has given his blessing, and we've heard that from more than one person.
Mr. Chair, if it's a self-pay program, I have no objections to this inclusion at all. I think it's appropriate, and from my point of view, I'm fine with it unless someone comes up with a reason to present that changes my mind. I don't have any problems with it.
Thank you very much, Representative Krupp, and I appreciate that, and we do want to confirm all of the issues, and I think we feel like if there has been an injustice or very little different than the 11.7 we were just discussing, if we didn't have Representative Leonard here to help us with some of the language regarding employees' certain rights, we probably have to be dealing with it next time to make sure that it was resolved properly. And so, okay. Any other questions of Ms. Ray? Thank you very much for your testimony. We may need to talk to you some more, but we appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Steve Delaney, would you feel comfortable coming forward and just discussing some of these issues so we all have a better feel for the administration portion of, you've just been handed a copy of Senate Bill 327-84 amendments of June 16th. Have you had an opportunity previously to see these at all?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Delaney, Manager of Government Relations at PERS. We did see suggested language about 2 days ago when it was first being discussed. I did run this past our health insurance manager, Gloria English, and she has no problem with it because it really doesn't impact the PERS program. PERS is used as an eligibility reference for the PEB program, but it has no impact on what PERS does for its health insurance.
So there is the overhead factor of providing the program, administering the program, collecting, dispersing on behalf of the program. That's all covered by the PEB's contribution.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. It does not impact PERS.
Is it a standard single health policy that we're talking about, or is it a combination for the 2,700 employees plus the State of Oregon University Systems optional retirement employees?
Chair, I would have to defer to the amendment sponsors on that, since, again, this wasn't impacting the PERS statute or PERS health insurance, which we offer.
Right. But so far as you are concerned, there would be no additional cost to the PERS. It's not your intention to have. Please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald has just come into the room. Director Fred McDonald.
What impact this amendment would have on PERS? The amendment being proposed by PEB.
Oh.
As indicating that it didn't have an impact on PERS.
Fiscal impact.
Mr. Chairman, good afternoon, and members of the committee, Fred McDonald. And what Steve Blaney says is correct, Mr. Chairman. It doesn't have any impact upon us at all. So we, therefore, if it doesn't jeopardize our bill and its passage, of course, I don't know what happened yet here this afternoon to it, but
we waited for you. We just the first item of testimony we've taken is just the receipt of Senate Bill 327-84 amendments, and you have those there in front of you, and those are substantially what you have seen within the last couple of days.
Okay.
From the PEB folks, and then we've received the testimony and letter from Ms. Mylea Ray, the administrator of the Public Employee Benefit Board. The issue that we came down to and the question was, the 2,700 employees, as a result of the mergers of the various boards and so forth, and historic board issues, and then there are also some State of Oregon perhaps the University Systems Optional Retirement Program folks that may be a different health insurance program that you would be have oversight and administer collecting and then dispersing under the program. All of your costs and overhead and administrative functions are all taken into consideration so that there is no net loss or net cost to the PERS system. Is that correct or not?
Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely right that there is no cost to the PERS system. Now, I would clarify, though, that PEB is a different organization than PERS, and I'm sure, and I know you know that, but I thought your comment kind of put us together, and although we work very closely together, we are separate entities.
And that entity is coming to you and asking you for to administer a benefit on their behalf.
Oh, no. No.
They're not.
No, sir.
Okay.
No, sir. No, they will do all that. This is an eligibility. How
they just
kind
use
of
you as the eligibility organization.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay. I beg your pardon. I thought in that process that in using you as the eligibility organization that you would basically have to receive and then disperse as an interim agent for them.
They had that in mind, Mr. Chairman. They hadn't told me that.
Oh, okay. So the
I don't, and I'm
year,
sure they reference
agency. Okay. All right. Okay. Well, I beg your pardon. I thought that there was a check that had to come in and a check that had to go out. And
no.
I knew that you were assuming no responsibility in the process.
Right.
But it's one step removed from that. That is that you basically just become the sponsoring agent in effect for the insurance itself or the reference agent for the sponsoring
insurances that they administer?
Actually, not even to that extent, Mr. Chairman. They have had an eligibility question and needed the language clarified to make certain that all retirees were eligible for the health insurance that they provide.
I see.
And this was a convenient vehicle to add that language to, and we're coincidentally involved because it happens to involve retirees, and that's where the coincidence really ends.
So they don't really even have to have any other nexus to the PERS system.
That's absolutely right, Mr. Chairman.
I see. I beg your pardon. I thought that they would actually run their insurance group would actually, their group would actually run a insurance check through the PERS system. The PERS system would then go ahead and launder it through to the ultimate carriers of the insurance company.
No, that's not.
That's my devious mind.
So we're fine with it if the committee is fine with it.
Okay. I appreciate that understanding. I beg your pardon. I thought that there was some administration required at PERS, and I'm sensitive to that. I'm concerned that we do not put any more burdens on PERS for administrative oversight or responsibility. If it's merely the vehicle to accomplish it, then that would amply explain that. We do not have substantive authority to include the Senate Bill 327-84 amendment. We will, for the purposes of this meeting, we will acknowledge the receipt of this testimony and the 8-84 amendment, seeking permission from Senator Duncan. It came originally, this is a referral from Senator Duncan's Committee on General Government at the Senate level, and I'm confident that, and it's been expressed that Senator Duncan will probably be very pleased to have this vehicle used here to do this. So, are there any other questions? I'm sorry to run so absolutely out in the dark on this. I thought that we had this. Actually, run the funds through the PERS system in order to use them as a vehicle.
I have some questions, but not about this issue.
Okay, all right. Well, with that issue aside, then let's go back to the body of 1127, then, and recognize Representative Leonard's question.
Sir, I just. I'm concerned that there might be some discussions about the retroactive portion of this bill. If there are, if you could tell me that, then I'd like to speak to that. If there aren't, let me speak to it.
Yes, there is a concern about the retroactive portion of the bill, where there have been no contributions made historically by the 260 positions, in the past for the CNF units, and that is of concern to me, and I visited briefly with Mr. Pepper regarding that, and I am concerned that this would place an additional fiscal responsibility on the balance of the employees of the state to do some catch up for folks who have not previously been members of the fire and police units, or police and firefighters units.
Well, I just want to articulate what my understanding of that cost is. As I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, Fred, is it's 1/100th of 1% of payroll of all state agencies beginning fiscal year 2001 and to 2003.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leonard, the 1/100th of 1% is correct. Now, the actual begin date would, you mentioned 2001?
Yeah.
I'm going to ask our actuary, Mr. Chairman, our actuary, Mark Johnson, is with me today, and he can address that. But I think it would be later than that, Representative Leonard, but Mark can address that. I think, because he's going to do evaluation at the end of 99, and the rates that are resulting from the evaluation of 1999 would go into effect, well, you're right, 2001, July 2001.
Well, for the record, Mark Johnson, the actuary with Norman and Roberts, and the consultant to the board, Representative Leonard, that's true. However, that's when the rate would go into effect, but the liabilities incurred as soon as the governor signs it. The way we present fiscals, we show what the impact would be, for example, in the 99-01 biennium, even if the rate isn't effective, that's what it would be. And what happens when the rate comes into effect then is the fact that the benefit was there in 99 and then no contribution was made to fund it is pay me now or pay me later. So it's actually going to be a little bit higher when they come around to paying for it in the year 2001. But that's a situation that all employers are used to, this lag because of the two-year valuation process and so forth. In terms of the fiscal, 1/100th of a percent is accurate. And that includes both future service and their retroactive piece.
So the actual impact on state budgets wouldn't occur until 2001?
That's correct.
Okay. And then the issue that I want to raise is this, and I just want to make clear why I'm raising this. I'll say it the right way. I don't know if Representative Clough has ever been affected by the State Conflagration Act, which is a provision in law that I have only once in my 22 years career with the Portland Fire Bureau.
Yeah, pyromaniacs are dead, so he's been involved with it more than once. He usually goes out to burn a few weeds around the corral from time to time,
and
the State Conflagration Act is a specific provision that gives the authority to the governor to, in effect, nationalize all fire agencies in the state. And I have been, although in my career there's been a number of times that's happened, I have been on duty only once when that happened. And I'm trying to remember the year, maybe somebody here can help me, it was the year of the, what was known as the Multnomah Falls Fire, 91 or 92 is what I'm thinking. Number two, right in there. So it was at that point that I learned the difference between a structural firefighter and a wildland forest firefighter. It's a big difference. There's nothing hardly similar. And after I'd been there a couple of days, I was really wanting to get back to the city, working next to these guys. I mean, it was we trained for it and been prepared for that eventuality. I'd been to Forest Park, fudging around up there a few times, but nothing of the magnitude that we dealt with there at Multnomah Falls. So I gained quite a respect for those men and women that are involved in that firefight. I was shocked to learn they weren't covered by the public safety portion. Back then, they weren't considered general service employees. And what particularly disturbs me about that, and specifically this discussion that may occur about the retroactivity, is when you look at who is currently covered, and I don't mean to take away from the ones who are covered. And okay, each one of them, I'm going to read some of them to you, but I think each of them deserve it. But certainly if these that I'm going to name deserve police and fire credits, those folks out there in the wildlands, in the forest, and climbing hills so steep that sometimes you have to get on your knees and climb, they certainly deserve it. Employees of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, they are not what we define as police officers. They don't carry weapons, nor do they make arrests, but they fall under the police and fire credits. Parole and probation officers, tough job. It is a very tough job, but they're also not police officers. Investigators of the Criminal Justice Division, again, not police officers. Do background checks, those kinds of things, they fall under. Employees at McLaren School, Hillcrest School of Oregon, and other youth facilities, youth correction facilities, who are required to hold a valid teaching license. They have supervisory, controller, teaching responsibilities over juveniles committed to custody of the Department of Corrections, the Oregon Youth Board. I think they deserve it. But certainly, if those employees are working in those jobs who deserve it, it's hard for me to understand that men and women have been performing this function for us for a long time shouldn't have some equity given to them, so that they are, at least for the time, and I could make an argument that they should receive the credit year-round. I mean, it just makes sense to me. But at least with the restrictive provision that we're looking at here in 327, which is one only when they're certified by the State Forestry Department, certainly in those periods of time when they're actively engaged in firefighting, or have been active, I guess the debate isn't when they are, but when they have done that, certainly equity, I would think, demands that they be given that retroactivity. And the reason I raised the issue of the cost is that in terms of the impact on state budgets, it just almost doesn't exist.
And I've heard that discussion, I think that it was very generous in March, but I've heard that discussion of this such a normal amount, and yet when we start talking about $234,000 a year, that would come a couple times over the additional amounts that we're being asked for from the Oregon
Well, which is all well and good, but we've made, as you know, some choices this session about other things that I don't really want to get into. That when you put those in the list of priorities on this, I'm not making an economic argument. If I hadn't had that one experience, I probably wouldn't be saying a word right now with those men and women. I don't know how Jeff feels, but he's had that same kind of experience as I have. I'm saying about the economic argument is that it really is very minimal in the context of the equity involved in this retroactivity. I mean, it's like we have for years been getting some savings at some people's expenses that involves their lives being put on the line for the state, and that bothers me. I mean, I think the cry for them being treated equitable outweighs whatever benefit we gained by saving the $300,000 beginning in 2001.
Yes, this. How do I explain to my police units who have opted out and then opted back in to the PNS units and have had to pay the retroactive benefit to join back in? How do I explain that to those particular units that these 260 employees should be treated more equitably, that is, paid for by all of the state employees as opposed to those employees who would opt back into the system at a later time?
That, you know, as I understand it, that liability is going to be paid, and it isn't paid by them. It isn't paid by your employees either. If they have negotiated the PERS pickup, if there is a pickup, the employer takes all of that up.
Unfortunately, the counties that I represent, majority of Eastern Oregon, and other 17 to 19 counties in Eastern Oregon don't have the latitude to, by and large, to just say, well, we'll pick up the full share. What was that, Measure 8, I guess, a few years ago that said, you know, they'll be half paid by each of the two entities, and then I understand 8 was eventually declared unconstitutional. Out of concern for Measure 8 and what it did, in Eastern Oregon, I don't know of any agency that didn't immediately on implementation date start splitting that, so the employee picked up half and the employer picked up half, of all of the PERS costs. In other words,
more than half and half, I think it was 6% of the employer's contribution, the employer paid.
All of that, didn't
Well, the employer paid whatever their rate was, which could be 9, 12, 15%, depending on their experience. The employees only paid 6%. I'm not familiar with the specific circumstances of what you're talking about. The ones that I am aware of what happened was that the governmental entity gave the employee a 6% raise before the implementation date and then required the employee to pay the 6%. If that's what happened, and somebody's now presenting to you some inequity, there's probably a piece of the story missing. Because the entities I'm familiar with I think there was like a December implementation date that passed in November, and most of those entities in that period of time negotiated a different way of paying the pickup, is what happened. And I know of none that did anything different.
That included in the bill.
That's why they did it before the implementation date. The bill precluded that occurring after December 5th
or January 1st.
And those governmental entities did this before the effective date of that.
That's what the intention of the implementation measure.
But again, I guess we have a way that the state of Oregon pays its PERS contributions, a blended rate, as I understood it explained by Fred yesterday. And I think that was for the benefit of the state. And, I mean, the other side of this is that these employees were doing exactly what the intent of the law was when we decided to give public safety employees an extra tool and they weren't receiving that benefit. I guess I'm just saying that's just not right. You know, for people that are actually out on the front lines doing the hard work, they should be treated equitably.
And so as I understand it, your position is that they should never have had to pay any of it anyway, even if they had been participating from day one.
And that's not my position. My position is that the cost of that benefit should have been paid since the PERS public safety provision was passed in the 1973 session, is when that should have started being paid for those employees. They should have never, I mean, a person who's out fighting forest firefighting is a firefighter and should have fallen, why they didn't fall under that definition 26 years ago, I don't know. Like I said, until this came up here, I wouldn't know what they meant giving it, given who we do give it to.
Okay. And when you say we give it to, I need to understand, because it's still my understanding that previous to some of the state negotiations a few years back, that the employees were picking up a portion of the costs, right, and the employer was not picking up all of the costs on the P&S units.
Not just P&F, but all of PERS employees at one time paid a 6% copay or employee contribution.
Regardless of whether you're general service or police and fire, it's all 6%. So the obligation of the member is the same.
Right. And was it in the 79 session or the 81 session that the legislature, 79 session, the legislature passed a law? And this is where the big, misunderstanding occurs about the pickup. The 79th session of the legislature said we're in a time of high inflation, people are negotiating high raises back then because of the high inflation, public employees are being underpaid, and the idea was, well, the 6% that the employees put in is after taxes. If we allow them to have that in the form of a raise, and then the state pays it. The state saves on payroll taxes, and the employee gets the benefit of quite a raise. So it wasn't like anything was given to anybody. It was done in lieu of a raise. The 6% was negotiated, and not just for police and fire, but for any collective bargaining unit that was at the table at that time. They sat down and they said, well, whereas we would otherwise negotiate a 6% raise, if you'll pick up what we're paying anyway, we'll call that good.
And again, for those that came in later or that
failed to opt in or opted out and then opted back in, and the employees were given an opportunity. And let me jump over to, I think it was a bill that may have been passed in the last legislative assembly relative to teachers who could opt into the program with an additional 4 years if they'd been teaching out of state and came back into Oregon to teach in Oregon.
But they had to pay the full actuarial cost of that.
Okay. And
that included veterans as well.
And why would we, okay, now tell me why with those public employees they would be treated in a different fashion than this group of public employees?
I don't think there are, but because what Marcus testified to is that 300 and whatever the unfunded liability is, in fact, will be reflected in the rate.
Yeah, the cost of this bill to the employer, the piece that's looking back or the past service piece, is actually the present value of employer state contributions that should have been made mm-hmm. for the time that you're going to grant them credit as police and fire. There's no difference to the member. If these individuals, these 260 people, had always been police and fire, the member would have paid the same thing. But the state would have paid more.
So the $360,000, or whatever it is only the state's portion.
Right. Part of it is the increase in the state rate in the future, and part of it is because they're going to be earning police and fire credit in the future, and the other part is the state's payment of contributions the state should have made had these people always been reflected as police and fire. But the impact to the member is none, because police and fire members pay exactly the same member contribution rate as general service people. So this liability has been created, if you will, as a liability of the state. The state pays the difference between whatever the member pays and whatever the cost of the benefit is, and all members pay the same rate, except for judges. 6%, except for judges. Everybody pays 6. So whether you're general service or police and fire, this difference in this benefit would have been funded by the state.
Mr. Chairman, is part of what you're referring to something that I have kind of a vague recollection of, and that was several years ago, maybe the 89 session, 91 session, that there were some individuals who had been classed as PNF at one time? Or no, how did it go? All of a sudden they became classed as PNF. But they had had service time with other public employers in this state, maybe local governments,
mm-hmm.
that would have qualified for PNF status. And what that the session decided there to do was to allow them to have that time as PNF, but they had to pay for it.
They had to buy it.
They had to buy it.
Out of the employee's own.
Yeah, and I can't remember what it was.
But that was time out of the system. No?
Here was time out of the system?
I think it was time out of the system. Here we're talking about time in the system.
Yeah, so it was time out of a PERS covered employee.
That's my recollection.
Yeah.
They were, in fact, out of the system because they weren't making contributions. The cities or counties or other agencies were to be making contributions to another program which may never have happened.
My recollection.
And basically leaving an unfunded liability. But really, when it was all said and done and settled, basically what happened was that people were out of the programs for as much as 2 or 3 or 4 years in some cases, before they could get back in. And then if they wanted to get back in fully, again, I'm not sure what the economic situations were in terms of what was going on in the economy at the time, but they had to come up with and purchase the units or purchase the
service time
for the time that they had been they continued with the jobs particularly and the issue came up. The issue came up that I actually discussed it with some of the police and firemen in our areas, that they had to, in order to in order to get back into the system, they had to buy back the service time that they had been excluded from the system. I don't know, I think what there was is it was actually a contribution made in their behalf to the old Ben Franklin or Equitable Savings and Loan or someone, and a lot of that was, you know, they were trying to tie interest rates and it didn't come to pass.
That's non-PERS, sure.
That's right. We did had the same thing with Fire District 10.
You did? Yeah.
What was that thing?
Connecticut General.
Connecticut General. But that's a different situation than this. That was a conscious decision on their part to do something different than this program.
What you're doing, though, make sure that I understand your position, you're saying even though they had a bargaining unit, and the bargaining unit bargained for certain benefits, rights, and privileges and benefits back during these historic times, we're now going to come back and modify the contract retroactively, and then there's a portion of the $338,000, which is for the benefit from this point forward, and there's a portion of the $338,000, which is a historic cost to bring them into the system.
No, this was not a subject of bargaining. How they are classed is not a subject of bargaining, which is why we have a bill for it. You have legislation that defines what employees are. That is not that's a prohibited subject of bargaining. That is not on the table. In other words, you can't sit down if this bill doesn't pass and say, I'm a forest firefighter, that I'm meeting with my employer, and I want to bargain, and I want to be a firefighter now. The employer goes, that's a prohibited subject of bargain. You can't even talk about it here. That's something that's dealt with in statute and statute only. It's not on the table.
Well, then if it's not on the table as to a bargaining issue from a historical standpoint, then certainly we would have the ability to try and differentiate the difference between the historical value and the present value of the future anticipated retirement benefits that they would receive. Well, it's divided up between the two. You've got some folks here that you're going to, that's proposed that we would be granting some rights to based upon some historical participation in the system when they weren't really participating in the system. And then you've got a cost associated with for approximately 30 years this would continue on, this 100% to 1% on all state employees would continue on for the next 30 years based upon future benefits that will accrue and inure to the benefit of these particular wildland firefighters.
Well, the future benefits are paid by the current assessment, whatever that might be, whatever market is.
That's
right,
got some portion of the $338,000.
It's about $200,000 per bayonet, and it's for future service.
It's for future service. So $100,000 is for retroactive.
Right.
About $138,000 retroactive.
It provides
presently fiscal is $334,000.
I thought the whole 334 was for prior service.
No, it isn't. So we're only arguing about $138,000.
$134,000. If it's $200,000
the retroactive portion
for the future benefits is $200,000.
Right.
And $134,000. Picks up the retroactive benefit.
Right.
And now that's for the next 30 years. That's based upon the next 30 years.
So the $134,000, is that an annual cost? Or does that pick up the unfunded liability
that's
for the prior service?
Biannual.
For the prior service.
Right.
So every...
I don't know the 337, I don't know that was my number, but it's $300,000 per biennium. $200,000 per biennium is future service, and the rest is a 30-year amortization of the liability created because contributions weren't made in the past.
Well, if it's 0.001% for the entire balance, or the entire amount, 334, it'd be approximately a third of that for the...
Yeah, right.
So...
Yeah, sir, a little bit more, yeah. I mean, if you did one or the other, it wouldn't show up in the rate. But combining it, the lowest increment that we use is out to the 100th of a percent like this. So, I mean, this doesn't show up. There's a cost, but it'd be so small that it wouldn't show up in the rate. But this is the 1/100.
Yeah, you know, again, I think my thrust isn't to debate the cost as much as it is that these folks, beyond everything else, actually perform these firefighting functions. There were, I mean, if you sat on TV and watched the news at 6 and saw these guys trounce around the Blue Mountains, who could have told you they weren't firefighters? Who would have convinced you that these weren't firefighters with the same benefit as any other firefighter?
And I guess my response to that is that we get the hot shot teams that come out of the SRD and the other folks and those are firefighters as well. They are federal firefighters, I think, coming out of the Forest Service, so they become BLM firefighters and there's no PNF available for them at all.
I
realize that, and
I think they actually make more money than by far than these guys, as I understand it, substantially more money. Why they do that?
I don't know what pay differential is.
My understanding goes, does anybody here know what the difference is?
Chair Pat Lutter, members of the committee. My name is Mike Farrelly, Deputy State Forester. Indeed, we are participating in what's called a complete and coordinated system of firefighting in the state. And that means that we fight fire with the rules under Conflagration Act and other agreements. We also fight fire when it occurs in Eastern Oregon with these very same people in cooperation with federal agencies. Indeed, the federal firefighters have a substantially higher base pay rate than most of our firefighters. And in fact, they do have a program, if they are federal employees, for the Forest Service for eligibility for police and fire benefits. That's something that this agency's firefighters have not been determined to be eligible for to date. But it is the subject of the litigation. And we had three basic objectives of supporting this legislation. One is the fundamental equity question that we've talked about here mostly today. Second is the simple need to provide fair benefits to recruit and retain future firefighters. We're finding that more and more difficult as we get aging workforces and so forth to entice people in when we're not offering the same kinds of benefits that are available to other firefighters. And then third, and this is a big business decision that I think needs to be considered along with these other two objectives, is to try to bring closure to the exposure that's out there of litigation because of the fact that the current statutory language can be interpreted and has been by some people, and the argument is still on the table as to whether or not these folks have always been firefighters under today's statutory language. And that's the debate that's currently ongoing. Current language, if it's interpreted the way it has been in general terms as firefighters, as someone whose duties include firefighting, then it could be a much larger exposure than what we've talked about here today, a much larger liability ultimately if a court decision is made using the general language that's out there rather than the restricted provisions that we're proposing and supporting for certification of those people that actually have the exposures.
Mr. Chair? So if what I'm hearing you say correctly is that by passing this legislation where we place some limits on what is makes you eligible for this benefit, and we make that retroactive, then we essentially take away any possible unfunded liability from a lawsuit based on the current statutory language. It could be interpreted as something different, and that these folks were always firefighters and they could sue us and we could have another expensive payment to be making.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, we can't guarantee that there wouldn't be additional litigation, but we think that the retroactive aspect of this is important because I can't really think of many people who are currently involved in the system that wouldn't accept that as an equitable solution. If this passes, we would take appropriate steps with PERS to work toward some very clear provisions in administrative rules that would define and clarify who the state forester would certify. And we think that then would resolve, or we would have acted in good faith. This would have been addressed. It would have then made it clear that the certification was limited to those that have the exposure to the hazards.
Mr. Chair, Mike, do you have litigation occurring now?
Yes, there is a current case. It was a contested case brought by one of our employees to the PERS board, at which time the Department of Justice advised the PERS board that they could incur personal liability and may not be justice may not represent them if subsequent litigation led to liabilities under this case. As a result of that, the PERS board, I think reasonably so given that perspective, said that they would prefer that this be referred to a judiciary, that matter be referred to a judiciary solution to relieve the board members of any potential liabilities. Subsequently, the Department of Justice has kind of rescinded their threat of not representing PERS board members in cases like this.
Okay. So, again, if I'm understanding this correctly, in reality, it sounds like the argument of Representative Leonard is something I certainly agree with in regards to we've got a lot of other people that are included in P&F and I think are less deserving, not that they're not deserving, but I'm saying that less deserving is what wildland firefighters are in my experience. Working with wildland firefighters has been very dangerous and very difficult work, and I think that they should be included. And I also share his surprise that they haven't been included all along, frankly. But again, the intent of this legislation is not so much his point that they should have been included. The intent of this legislation really is to in essence, blunt the possible continuation of lawsuits for these benefits. Because these folks weren't retired based on the current statutory language. Is that correct?
That is one of the factors that has, I believe, led the board to propose this legislation.
That's a very fair analysis. The retroactivity here is for all service performed, as the bill states. Is that correct? So if you have people who've been employed 15 years or 20 years, all of their past employment that would qualify under the 600-hour rule per year
and qualify as a wildland firefighter.
And qualify as a wildland
firefighter. For those months.
Okay, for those months, then for all those years, then that person would be picked up. Okay. And if I'm understanding this correctly, this is a $338,000 or $334,000, whatever it is, liability
only, or is that per year?
For biennial.
That is a biennial
for 30 years minimum.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Cook, I would like to put a bit of a caveat.
Okay.
I don't want to confuse the issue at this point, but the 1/100th of a percent of payroll really represents a range of dollars, and that 336 or whatever it is an approximate number. And it could range upward, it could range downward, but still our actuary feels confident that the 1/100th is the right number. In fact, it's probably less than what 1/100th times the state payroll is. But anyhow, so it's a range.
Sure. It's a range.
It's not a precise art. It's
clear, it rounded up to 1/100th.
Okay. So it's
somewhere
between
the
we're on the high side at
1/100th.
Okay.
And the tire service is like a third of that total amount.
All right, that's what Mark indicated to me. I'll try.
On a biennial basis, somewhere around 130,000, somewhere in that range on a biennial basis is prior service rate.
Okay. And I guess what I was working towards in that process, what I was working towards as a potential settlement in this process was to go back and examine that $134,000 historical benefit in relationship to the fact that there has been no declaratory judgment at this particular point. I don't have the experience as a firefighter. I don't have the experience with wildland or becoming a certified wildland firefighter. But whose primary duties are to control or to abate uncontrolled fires. But my sense of the whole issue is that there is some litigation, but the other side of that is that it has not been totally resolved, and we might be part of the solution if we can work towards it, but I would like to try and work towards it with the least cost to the state general funds, recognizing that if the future service cost is $200,000, and roughly a third of that comes from general fund, then what you're talking about is you're talking about an extra $67,000 per year in the future, and seeing what could be done with regard to those employees who were fighting fires for a number of months of the year, but weren't classified as police officers or firefighters because they had other duties. It's my understanding that for the Forest Service, they actually had other duties and during the balance of the year, in large part. Is that correct, or some were exclusive firefighters?
Because of the typically seasonal nature of firefighting, wildland firefighting, that is true. However, they remain on duty. We have people in Alaska now, for example. We have sent people out of state under reciprocal agreements to Florida and other states at all times of the year. We have mutual aid agreements with the rurals, which means that our folks respond with the rurals, even in the winter when there's a probability of the fire spreading to wildland fuels. What we have tried to do to keep the costs down is to deal with the prorated aspect of these jobs, looking at the seasonal aspect. With the full knowledge that when we average out the amount of time that our wildland firefighters are exposed to hazards during a four-month period, it has consistently showed that it is greater than the average number of hours spent by a rural firefighter who has full-time year-round duties and receives full-time year-round credits under the PERS system. And it's been substantially more, and we've compared against Tualatin and some of the other districts that have very heavy fire loads. And it really is that our season is focused during a shorter period of time, but the intensity of that more than makes up for it in the hours that are actually spent in the exposure to fire.
How long have you known that those circumstances existed, though?
We've been working on this since the mid-70s. We've been intensively working with this since the direction was given by Governor Goldschmidt for PERS to review the matter and come up with equitable standards. It was about that point that I'm most familiar with our efforts to try to get this through. There have been a number of reasons that have been offered over the years why it was not. Most of those reasons have to do with the number of other groups that were tagged on with the wildland firefighters and reluctance to pass them through the screen of eligibility. And that's remained the constant issue as this has come forward. It's only been the last two sessions that we have seen this particular proposal pulled out to be exclusively dealing with wildland firefighters. Most people that we talked to, including the rural and municipal firefighters, are surprised that that's the typical response we get, is the one that Representative Leonard suggested, is that people are shocked and surprised and think it is inequitable that we have not been included in the definition as firefighters.
Representative Nesterly yesterday mentioned the two, three firefighters for wildland fires. Are they covered?
I'm not sure how their coverage is provided. They are a district. We have, there are three operating associations that contract with the state of Oregon to provide firefighting services. They typically have their own retirement programs, and I don't know if any of them are PERS covered versus carrying alternative insurance programs and annuity programs for their employees.
Typically, the alternatives include firefighter special units, you know, like
firefighter special units. Those associations are dedicated exclusively to firefighting activities. While our people, we have the advantage in terms of effectiveness and efficiency to be able to keep our people on all year round with most of their costs associated with other program activities. And that is what has allowed us to keep our costs down for the state of Oregon, on behalf of the state of Oregon, and still remain a highly competent, effective firefighting organization compared to what we've experienced in the Forest Service and other places where their resources are diluted. They are not there for initial attack, and we have an obligation to the members that we serve, to the constituent landowners and to the state of Oregon, to keep those costs down. This is an effective way to do that. But it has placed us in jeopardy of getting the benefits because it's too easy for people to say, you are not full-time professional firefighters exclusively, even though we remain in readiness and have all of the capacities and capabilities and all the hours as though we were full-time firefighters.
Mr. Chair, I have a
yes.
We've
event that I'd like to right now.
Beat this almost to death. We appreciate your testimony here today and your bearing this through with us. It's given
a lot to think about. Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and carry over the public hearing on Senate Bill 327 for tomorrow. I'm excited for tomorrow afternoon.